Welcome to Recent Developments in the Management of Relapsed Refractory Multiple Myeloma, what happened at the ASH 2025 meeting, with a focus on BCMA-targeted therapy and investigational agents. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Sagar Lonial from the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, to discuss key papers from the ASH meeting.
This abstract was probably, if there were a sort of bell of the ball for myeloma, this would have been it. This was probably the highly anticipated TEC plus DARA. You've got two drugs that are highly effective. Why not combine them together? And so this was really looking at a randomized phase three trial of TEC and DARA compared to DPD or DVD. And the median follow-up on this trial was close to 3 years. So it's a pretty mature data set. And again, what I think you'll see is that the TEC was actually following the DARA dosing schedule. So weekly for 8 doses, then it went to every other week for 8 doses, and then both went to monthly dosing overall. And what I think we were all really struck by is the progression-free survival, which at 36 months was 83% for TEC DARA compared to only 29% for DPD or DVD. And I think what really struck us all was it looks like many of those patients on the TEC DARA arm are in long-term remission. I mean, it's the follow-up is too short to say that's a plateau, but it certainly looks a lot like a plateau. Many of those patients were, in fact, MRD negative. And so I think understanding some of the key subtleties in this, and that is looking at the overall survival and the PFS for TEC DARA are superimposable, which is really exciting. What I think you'll notice is that at the beginning of the overall survival curve, the TEC DARA arm drops below the standard of care. And that happens for only the first 6 months. And during the first 6 months, IVIG prophylaxis was not mandated. Once they mandated IVIG prophylaxis, that drop in the survival curve that was likely associated with infections and not giving mandatory IVIG went away. And that's what allowed that plateau to develop at 36-month follow-up. So it does require a little bit of aggressive immunoprophylaxis. But with that aggressive immunoprophylaxis, you can see these outstanding results at 3 years.
How do these data compare to previous, you know, single-arm data? Was it this kind of outcome seen before?
Yeah, I mean, the early data with TEC DARA did look very encouraging. I think we all were sort of saying, well, maybe those were cherry-picked patients. It's hard to know. But this was a randomized phase three trial, so it's hard to argue with that data. I think, to me, the main take-home is make sure that you're ready with your antibiotic prophylaxis and that you're very vigilant to reducing infections. At ASH this year, I did present an update on the ocular events from an amalgamated analysis of both DREAM-7 and DREAM-8. And we did this not just with many oncologists, but we actually did this with some ophthalmologists who were partners with us in this process as well. And one of the really interesting thing when you begin to go back and look at the way that there is grading is you recognize that the KVA scale really looks at two separate metrics, and you take the worst of the two metrics to do the grading. So on the left, what you would see or what you think about is the exam done by the ophthalmologist. That's where they're looking at the number of microcyst-like deposits on the cornea, and that they grade that as 1, 2, 3, or 4. And oftentimes, if they've got more than just a few scattered microcysts, it'll be at least grade 2 or higher. The other way that goes into this measurement is the BCVA, or best corrected visual acuity. And this is using a more traditional Snellen-like eye chart. And so what you see in this context is that anything greater than 20/50 vision is considered a grade 2 or higher change in visual acuity. So you can have grade 2 by the exam done by the ophthalmologist and not have a change of vision greater than 20/50. What does that mean practically? It means that most patients who had grade 2 by the KVA scale actually did not have a significant change in their visual acuity. They could still read, they could still drive, they could still do many of the activities of daily living that we think about. And so I think that that disconnect between an exam versus a clinical finding is what has led to a lot of the confusion associated with belamaf-associated ocular adverse events. What we also know is that unilateral BCVA, meaning just looking at one eye, is different than bilateral. And in fact, if you look at unilateral changes, it was almost 69% of patients, whereas bilateral was only 34%. And that's because the impact can be different on the two eyes. And we know that the two eyes work together to try and correct for changes in visual acuity. So if you look at binocular vision, it's actually a much lower number of patients, 34%, that had 20/50 or worse compared to just unilateral. And that's why most patients will say, I don't notice much here, or if I do, it's a little dry eyes or a little itchy eyes, but it doesn't necessarily impact their visual acuity. Now, the last piece that I'll address on this was the reversibility. And what we saw in almost all patients in DREAM 7 and DREAM 8 was, in fact, reversibility. The average time on bilateral BCVA was 7 weeks. Unilateral, it was 9 weeks. Again, telling you that in bilateral vision, which is the way most ophthalmologists look at this, you get faster recovery and less impact on visual acuity, but the testing was all done and mandated for unilateral vision. So I think it just gives me more comfort when I talk to patients that you're going to be okay. If you're not okay, we'll hold the dose, and over time, we'll get you better. And ultimately, the dosing is every 8 to 12 weeks, which has a much lower incidence of severe ocular adverse events.
So what's the actual trigger to hold it? What type of grading outcome in either one of those measurements will lead to hold?
Grade 2. So if the ophthalmologist says it's grade 2, just looking at the slit lamp, you're going to hold until it resolves to grade 1.
And then what about acuity?
So acuity would be 20/50 or worse. So if you have either of those, then you get upgraded to grade 2.
And then what about people who start out before treatment with 20/50?
Yeah, I mean, you would try and correct their vision better than 20/50 before they even come to the trial. That didn't happen with many folks where they were worse than 20/50 coming into it. That does change the sort of KVA version of the best corrected visual acuity. So that's a little bit more difficult to deal with.
So it's corrected visual acuity with glasses then?
That's right.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. What we're going to talk about now is the combination of belamaf with VRD induction in patients with transplant-ineligible newly diagnosed myeloma. And we're going to look a little bit at efficacy as well as improvements and resolution in terms of the visual acuity. And so this was data initially presented by Dr. Usmani and his colleagues, and this was updated at ASH this year. And what we see, again, quite nicely, is that depending upon the dose and schedule of belamaf that is used, you see 100% response rate when you combine Bela with traditional VRD. And so there were three different schedules that were evaluated. One was 1.9 mg per kg given every Q8 or Q4 weeks. Another was 1.9 mg per kg given every Q6 and then Q8. And the third was 1.4 given every Q6 and then Q8 dosing as well. So really trying to understand the impact of target dose as well as frequency in between dosing and the impact on overall response rate. What I think, again, was quite interesting, again, these were small cohorts of patients. They weren't huge numbers, but we did see MRD negativity rates in patients with CR or better. As high as 100%, as low as 50%, depending upon the dose and the schedule that was used. And more importantly, what we did see was that the incidence of ocular findings, particularly grade 2 or higher, was there. It was higher in the highest dose cohort. It was not that dissimilar in the 1.4 dose cohort, and it was about 74% in all patients overall. If you then begin to look at the percentage of patients that had best corrected visual acuity that got worse than 20/50, In all cohorts, it was only 27%. And in the three main dosing cohorts, it was about 50%, which tells you that almost half the patients didn't have changes in visual acuity of worse than 20/50. And again, this was reversible in all patients that were evaluated. So I think Bella will be brought up front to newly diagnosed myeloma. There is, in fact, a DREAM 10 study looking at Bela-Lendex versus Dara-Lendex head-to-head in transplant-ineligible multiple myeloma. And just, again, getting comfortable with holding the dose and adjusting the dose is ultimately going to be how we move forward.
So, yeah, I'm kind of curious where you think Bela may or may not fit in the first-line setting. And one thing that's kind of interesting is I haven't seen too much about Bela plus anti-CD38. Is there some reason that's the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think that right now they are not combining with an anti-CD38. They've gone head-to-head against an anti-CD38. I think many of the – there's not a huge rationale for that combination per se other than perhaps the CD38 depleting Tregs, allowing you to be more responsive to a BCMA-directed therapy. But when you have an ADC, it's not clear how much of that you really need for greater efficacy.
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking two very effective agents that don't have a lot of toxicity. Usually you think about combining them.
Yeah. I mean, I think the partnership with an IMID or a PI makes good sense as well. And so one of the things that I do have some concerns about, and this will come up later on in discussions on, for instance, BCMA bispecific plus an anti-CD38, is sort of combined immunosuppression and infection risk. So if you're trying to potentially reduce that, you may want to separate those agents temporally to do that.
Any predictions of what they're going to see with this, Bela-Lendex? I guess you'd expect it to be better than Dara-Lendex.
Yeah, you know, the original data that came from the Greek group, Dr. Turpos and colleagues, his MRD negativity rates were significantly higher than was seen in Maya. And when you dose Bela every 3 months, the ocular toxicity really reduces significantly. And I think what it does is ultimately portend for a longer remission duration. That's why we're testing it head-to-head, but certainly the predictions are it will be longer than what was seen with Maya. We're going to start off talking a little bit about BCL2 inhibition in the context of relapse myeloma. And there were two studies presented at ASH 2025 that really talked about this. The first was a trial that combined venetoclax with iberdomide and dexamethasone, specifically in the context of 1114 multiple myeloma. And what I think was really quite exciting about this is it showed feasibility of this combination. I think we're all very excited about the availability of iberdomide as a new CELMoD. It's sort of more potent than lenalidomide or pomalidomide. And in many ways, this is an all-oral compound combination that I think many patients would be excited to take as well. What I think was encouraging was obviously a very high overall response rate, over 80%, which is certainly better than we would expect to see with venetoclax and dexamethasone alone in this context. The most common adverse event was neutropenia, which is a known side effect, particularly for combinations with venetoclax as well as with iberdomide. There weren't really any significant issues with febrile neutropenia. And so I think given that there's not mucositis or other complications, this is a manageable potential adverse event using things like G-CSF support. The other was an updated phase 1b2 study combining sonrotoclax, which is the new BCL2 inhibitor, with carfilzomib and dexamethasone, also in the 1114 subset. And what I think was really exciting about this is that clearly this is very active. And we know the PI BCL2 inhibitor combination is very active, both from preclinical as well as clinical work using venetoclax. And what I think what we really were excited to see from this trial was really data on the overall response rate, which in one cohort was as high as 100%. And to me, what this really suggests is that BCL2 inhibition, particularly for the 1114 subset, is in fact quite exciting Whether or not venetoclax is going to be our agent of choice, I think really depends on phase three trials with sonrotoclax. And for those of you who saw some of the data presented at ASH this year, my colleague Jonathan Kaufman actually demonstrated that 11/14 translocated patients who fail to achieve a VGPR with induction actually do quite poorly. And so there clearly is an important need for this BCL2 targeted approach. And I think these two trials are going to be part of that backbone to improve responses, even in the newly diagnosed setting down the road.
So one follow-up question. Right now, what do we know about the difference between venetoclax and sonrotoclax, either sort of from translational work or clinical work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thought is that sonrotoclax is a little bit more potent. It binds perhaps a little bit tighter. In vitro, it's hard to see big differences between them. But certainly, the adverse event profile for the sonrotoclax combinations looks to be a little bit more favorable than what we saw with venetoclax before.
Also, any interest in looking beyond 11/14?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we know that there are subsets of patients that don't express the 11/14 translocation that still overexpress BCL2. And those are called the BCL2 high subgroup of patients. Vikas Gupta from our center actually published data on a flow cytometry approach to be able to measure that, looking at four simple markers. And what I think he nicely demonstrated was there are some patients who are not 11/14 that are BCL2 overexpressors, but they are enriched in the 11/14 subset. So that's probably the place to start.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Loniel, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Recent Developments in the Management of Relapsed Refractory Multiple Myeloma. What happened at the ASH 2025 meeting focused on BCMA-targeted therapy and investigational agents.